Okay, so this talk is going to be a review of some works done on mapping the quantum circuit, mostly through the adiabatic computing model. And these are the references. Andrew Charles already mentioned this about this briefly in his introductory talk, and I'm going to elaborate on this. And the subject by itself may not be it's sort of like a proof of metal principle, but it turns out that there are a lot of interesting techniques and observations involved, so people might find use for them in other research areas. So okay, here are the references for this talk. And this is simply the outline. The theme is really about encoding quantum circuit into a smooth time-dependent Hamiltonian. So let me start with a very straightforward way to map this circuit into a Hamiltonian. Suppose we have, suppose we have a Hamiltonian with some spectrum, E sub n, and some eigenstates as this. And we ask, well, suppose I want my eigenstate to be transformed by some unitary operator U. What do I have to add to the Hamiltonian to do that? So this statement itself already tells me what I have to add. It is specified as this. And in the trivial case, where you want to leave the spectrum unchanged, that is, you want to keep a constant gap, the new Hamiltonian is nothing but UHU Lagger, which is a similarity transform. Right. So this gives you a very naive algorithm, which is to take a quantum gate U, compute this k equals I minus I log U, exponentiate it, and then do this U to the HU to the Lagger, take t from 0 to 1. And then you will have this very nice adiabatic evolution that takes the state 0 to state 0, 0. The problem with this is that my initial Hamiltonian is, let's say, one local on all the qubits, that is like a sigma z on all the qubits. As soon as you start applying these u's, it's going to grow, the locality is going to grow, it's going to become two local, three local, etc. So the question is, can we somehow avoid this problem by if we are willing to vary the gap? Or, I mean, after all, this is we only care about the ground state and the first excited state, and we have a lot of room to vary this gap. So you might ask, well, whether we can do some kind of approximation so that this adiabatic evolution still tracks the evolution of the quantum circuit. So to answer that question, let's look at the theorem by Hasselgroff, Newton, and Osborne. And the statement of the theorem is over here. And in plain words, it basically says that suppose you have, in a special case, suppose you have a k-local Hamiltonian, that is a Hamiltonian, that's a sum of terms, each of which only act on k bodies. It's obvious that any state psi, its expectation value for its energy, it's only going to depend on the reduced density matrix on those k qubits. So conceivably, you can have orthogonal states with exactly the same reduced density matrix. And that means they will have they will be degenerate in energy. So for example, if I consider the GHC state, state of all 0 plus all 1s, it's easy to check that the state all 0 minus all 1, which is orthogonal to it, has exactly the same reduced density matrix on any k local operators when k is less than n. So that means these two states have to be degenerate. And this is pretty much what the theorem says. So because we can generate this GHC state using a very simple quantum circuit, that means you cannot in general find an adiabatic evolution with the local Hamiltonians that uniquely and exactly track the evolution of the circuit. So with this in mind, what can we do? Well, one, you can try to track approximately. I mean, after all, this inequality sort of tells you what the gap has to be in terms of how close you are the state you want. And two, you can try to add ancillary qubits so that you change the coupling topology of the Hamiltonian. And three, you might say, well, I don't need my bound state to be unique. The gigabit evolution could still work even if the bound state is degenerate. So we will see that all these three elements somehow appear in the discussion that follows. So now let's look at a different approach. This is what I call a history approach, originally due to Kitaya, and perhaps we could say Feynman as well. So this technique, the way Kitaya first described it, is not developed for adiabatic computing, but for proving that the local Hamiltonian problem is QMA complete. So the class QMA, the complexity class QMA, is a quantum equivalent of MP, in which if I give you a solution from a quantum state, I will have a quantum circuit that tells you whether this is the correct solution of the problem. And the local Hamiltonian problem is just the problem that if I give you a local Hamiltonian, I want you to tell me whether its lowest eigenvalue is small or large. For example, whether it's close to zero or bounded away from zero. And like three sets.
Could you go back and explain what you had in the previous slide?
Yes.
Because, I mean, you tell us something as if we had already read all this stuff. So
no, this is not too important because I'm just explaining this.
We have slow, so could you slow it?
Sure.
This is an adiabatic workshop.
Yes.
Right, okay. Well, I mean, so
QMA.
You will see, I mean, don't worry too much about QMA, but you will see below that how it's related to adiabatic computing. Okay, so QMA is the class, is the complexity class such that if I give you a solution for a problem, I claim this is a solution, you will be able to check it using a quantum circuit. Right, so it's kind of similar to class MP, except that you use a quantum circuit, for example, a classical circuit to check it. All right, and the local Hamiltonian problem is just the problem, a set of problems such that I give you a local Hamiltonian, and I want you to tell me what the ground state is roughly, whether it's large in some sense or small in some sense. And it turns out that every single QMA problem can be mapped into a local Hamiltonian problem. Much like the way you map the NP complete problem.
Can you detail this definition?
Sure.
Because we have to translate between this mathematical language and what you're saying. And that's the most difficult part.
Yes, but since I don't have too much time, can I come back to this at the end if you're interested? Because, I mean, you just need to know the general idea. The details is not too important at this point. Well, I can have talk about it afterward.
I don't understand.
So, is that okay?
To make sure it's clear what the local Hamiltonian problem is, don't worry about it. There are too many complexity classes to worry about. So the K local means that you have at most a K particle interaction.
That's I understand.
Right. So then the problem is to determine whether the largest eigenvalue is in some range. Okay, where the range is less than 1/1 polynomial n.
Yeah, I'm talking about this because when you look up this literature on adiabatic computing using the history state, you get a lot of stuff about QMA. So I want to give a very brief idea what it is, but you don't need to know too much detail for the purpose of this talk. Okay, so you can think of a local Hamiltonian as just like KSAT, so a set of constraints. So the way you map this QMA problem into a local Hamiltonian problem is to follow a similar proof for the NP completeness of KZ. You say, I'll try to find some kind of satisfying assignment, which is in this case a quantum state, such that it's the history of the entire computation of the verifier. And so, abstractly speaking, you want some terms in your Hamiltonian that checks that the output of your circuit is indeed one, that this is indeed the right solution. And you want some terms to check that every gate in your quantum circuit is applied correctly. So I haven't told you what explicitly they are, but this is a general idea. This is what you want the H to achieve. And then you are not really constraining the input of the circuit in the history, because you don't know whether such an initial state, such a solution exists. In fact, this Hamiltonian will tell you, if you put minus ground state, it will tell you whether such an initial state exists. So in order to change this, about this framework for adiabatic computing, instead of having a constraint on output, I have constraint on the input. So I don't know whether my output is going to be 0 or 1, but I know my initial state exactly. So I can come up with a Hamiltonian that says at time equal to 0, the initial state is the state I want, I assign an eigenvalue 0, otherwise I assign something, some large eigenvalues. And in this case, you want to replace this very fine circuit for the QMA problem by the circuit you want to map. So let's look at what these Hamiltonians have to be. So what do I mean by history? It is a very abstract thing. So so here is how I would define it. Let gamma 0 to gamma L be the intermediate states of the quantum circuit. In general, for quantum circuit, these intermediate states may not be orthogonal to each other. But you can make them orthogonal when you include a clock such that every time you apply a gate, you flip the clock. And that way, you will get something orthogonal. And by history state, I really just mean the linear superposition of all these intermediate states, gamma 0 to gamma L. So what kind of age would have this as my ground state? Well, just observe that. Suppose I have a matrix 1 minus 1 minus 1, 1. The ground state is 1, 1. So you can sort of use this trick and stack up these matrices. And so my sigma, my summation of H prop, these Hamiltonians that ensure each case applied correctly, in the basis of gamma 0 to gamma L, will look like this. Does that make sense? So the key idea in making the Hamiltonian local, so since at the beginning I thought about this problem of having to construct Hamiltonian that's local, so to make this as local as possible, the key is to come up with some approximation for these operators, such as gamma t plus 1, gamma t going to gamma t plus 1, that's local. So here's one example. So here I represent my clock using this unary representation, that is, clock t equals to 3 is 1, 1, 1, or 0, etc. So every time I increase my clock, I flip a qubit. So to take gamma t to gamma t plus 1, I have to flip a qubit, and I have to apply the gate. So if we do it this way, this is a free local construction. And to ensure that you don't get any of the illegal clock states, because I mean, you can have a clock state that's like 0, 1, 0 or something, which is illegal, it doesn't mean anything. So to exclude those states, you need to add some penalty to the bad states. And if you do it this way, then this will approximate this operator.
What's your definition of an illegal clock state?
I want to represent my clock using this 1, 1, 1 or 0 representation. Okay, so time equal to t equals to 4 will be 1, 1, 1, 1 and all 0.
Okay, so why can't you just
But in principle, my Hilbert space will include states such as 0, 1, 0, 1, etc. And that means nothing for us. So we don't want to consider those states. We won't add a penalty to anything that gets into those legal
states.
Why
is it 0, 1, 0, 1, 6?
Oh, it's not a binary representation. It's a unary representation.
Ah, I see.
Yep. Okay.
You have to enlarge your resources or something like that.
Anyway, that's sort of the point of having these ancillary qubits.
If you have many steps and you have to add a lot of qubits, it's not a bad thing.
Well, it depends. I mean, you just have, if there are L steps, you just need to add L qubits. That's quite a lot, but not too much from a complexity point of view. All right. So what's the gap of this Hamiltonian? So I've shown you what some sum of H prop looks like. So at the input constraint is even simpler. I just say at clock time equals to 0, I need my input to be something something. If it's something something, the eigenvalue is 0, otherwise it's 1. So since both of these Hamiltonians, like something that looks like this, is It's something we can calculate exactly. So we know the spectrum for each of them. And if both of them has a minimum, has a gap of, that's larger than lambda, you can calculate the gap of the sum of this sum by, you can bound the gap of the sum by lambda times the maximum of the overlap of the overlap of the kernel, the null space. I mean, it's something you can prove, but it's so intuitive, I hope. Yes.
When you look at the matrix that you have before, mm-hmm. with two on the diagonal and minus one on the other.
Yes, this one.
If the matrix is L by L, the gap is 1 over L.
Yes, okay. Correct.
So what you're saying is that if you add up these gates, then you have a correction. It's a polynomial in L in general?
Yes, yes.
The gap
right. Right. Here, here you can see that the lambda is something like 1 over L.
This is the Laplacian.
It's the Laplacian.
No, it's not the Laplacian.
No, this is the Laplacian.
No, because it's not the usual Laplacian for a lattice system, because he's only using a particular set of gates which might not correspond to how you would label nearest neighbors on the lattice.
That's not the question. So the previous was the Laplacian, the one dimensional Laplacian. Yes. So he says one on lambda squared. Yes.
No, but it's not in the sense of a lattice, because you're using a very very restricted
yes.
set of states.
Okay.
It has the same spectrum.
Anyway, let's not worry about whatever it's L squared, L cubed, versus all the really matters to us is that it's one of the polynomial L.
You want to bound the gap from below.
Yeah, that's an upper bound.
That's an upper bound.
Yeah. Okay. Not a
lower. Oh, wait. Oh, this is the wrong sign.
Okay.
sorry about that. Okay, I changed
it. No,
so, in summary, the abelian algorithm would be the following. You start with an initial state that looks like this, where this part really sets your gamma zero, what your gamma zero has to be. And then at the end, you have this Hamiltonian that imposes this superposition. And in written out explicitly in the basis, gamma zero, gamma L, it looks like this, very simple. At the beginning, this initial state forces you to be in state one, and then at the end, the ground state is this superposition, okay? So now we have a well-defined algorithm, and we have to estimate its gap, because we want to do this linear interpolation from initial to final. You want to estimate its gap. And here I'll roughly sketch the idea, this proof, using from the reference, the first reference I showed. When x is small, you can prove that the gap is not too small by saying that at the beginning you have 0, 1, 1, 1, 1. When you increase s by a little bit, you get some new matrix. And there's a theorem, known as the Gershwin circle theorem, that says the new eigenvalue, say around b, is within the radius of b plus minus the sum of all the absolute value on other values in the row. So you can show that so that means the new eigenvalue around a, instead of being zero, it's something that can at most be 1/3. And likewise, the new eigenvalue around B is something that has to be at least 2/3. The gap is at least 2/3. For the case of S greater than 1/3, the proof is more complicated. So here we can make use of this interesting properties of stochastic matrix. So a stochastic matrix is a matrix with positive entries and whose row or column sum to 1. It's a transform matrix in, you think of it as a transform matrix in the graph, like Markov chain. And it has the property that the gap between the largest eigenvalue and the second largest eigenvalue is related to a quantity called conductance, or in graph theory, it's also known as expansion parameter, I think. And the reason is the following, or roughly the following. So if you think of this stochastic matrix as transferring these weights in the graph, there will be a steady state distribution. That's really the largest eigenvector with eigenvalue 1, okay? And just how would you calculate second largest, what would the second largest eigenvalue look like? Well, since it's orthogonal to the largest eigenvalue, which has all positive entries, it has to have some part that's negative and some part that's positive. So, in some sense, if the positive part mixes a lot of negative part, the value, this expectation value, is going to be kind of small, and vice versa. So this quality called conductance, exactly this concept. You want to, for all ways of dividing these nodes into two sets, you want to find the minimal flow between these two sets. That's roughly what conductance means. So the conductance is really the same thing in some sense as the second largest eigenvalue. So the conductance turns out to be proportional, or I think it's the square of conductance is proportional to the gap between the largest and second largest eigenvalue in the stochastic matrix. So what does this have to do with our problem? Well, we can map our H of S into a stochastic matrix such that the gap between the lowest and second lowest eigenvalue of H is of the same order as the gap between the largest and second largest eigenvalue of P. Right. And once you've done that, here's an argument on how to show that conductance is bounded.
What's mu for
me? Let's see. Mu, I think it's the largest eigenvalue of G. The largest eigenvalue of G, actually. You just want to make sure that the largest eigenvalue of P is 1. So you have to divide by the largest eigenvalue of G. Yeah, this is a really hand-wavy rough sketch, so I don't want to go into too much detail. But the basic idea is, it so happens that this, if you think of it as a Markov chain, or a random walk, it's really just a simple random walk on a straight line. Each vertex represents this history, the gamma 0 to gamma L, right? And suppose that the final distribution, that's alpha 0 to alpha L. It's pretty easy to see that this is a monotonic distribution. When S equals to 1, you have everything, all the weight is in gamma 0, and at the end, S equal to 1, you will have an even distribution. So somewhere in between, you expect some kind of monotonic distribution as the steady state of the P. And with this in mind, we can say, if I divide this set into two parts and want to minimize the flow between them, suppose I choose the set. I choose the set to be something like this. I want to calculate the flow from this node to this node. And I know that if I choose my set to be in the definition of conductance, this is the set I choose cannot have the size that's greater than 1/2. That means I would have a lot of weight left in the rest of the graph. And since this node is larger than this node, and so on, so this node must have quite a bit of weight in it. So using this kind of trick, you can show that the flow, which is proportional to the weight on these nodes, is bounded by 1 over L from below. Does that make a little bit of sense? I can't go into too much detail, but I hope that's somewhat intuitive, right? So if you believe in this, now we have a perfectly fine adiabatic algorithm that is in some sense mapped from the quantum circuit. So what does this have to do with holonomic quantum computing? So let me first explain what holonomic quantum computing means. So it's in fact a different kind of adiabatic evolution that people have considered in constructions of quantum computer. It's well known in physics that when you take you parameterize the Hamiltonian by some parameters, say x, y, you change the Hamiltonian adiabatically around a loop in x, y. When you come back, you can, in general, get a Berry phase. And if your eigenstate is degenerate, then there will be a rotation within that space when you finish the loop. And that's something that cannot engage away. So people have suggested you can use this non-abelian Berry fix to implement quantum computation. So the sort of key here is really that we have degenerate eigenspace. So let's go back to the history approach. The Hamiltonian we just look at, I said, well, there's a part that's, that constrains the input and a part that makes sure that each k is correctly applied, the h sum of h prop. Suppose we omit the term that constrains the input. Since with the input constraints, it's easy to check that the input on, or I should say, okay, so in the original evolution, h input on the all the states throughout the evolution is really zero, right? Because it checks that the history is correct. And if the history throughout evolution is correct, then it's always zero. That means you could have omitted the h input constraint and still get the same evolution as long as you prepare the initial state in the eigenstate of h input. In other words, the propagation part preserves the eigenspace of h input. So let's look at a simple example. Suppose I have one gate circuit, and I want to map this into an adiabatic evolution using the history approach. The initial and final states are these, okay? And you can easily construct a simple initial Hamiltonian and final Hamiltonian that does the job. Now notice that this set of initial and final Hamiltonian could have taken the state psi I prime to state psi f prime as well, where psi I prime is rotated by the unitary transformation v. So this is the degeneracy I want to point you to. So here's an idea. Suppose I parameterize this Hamiltonian by parameters p, q, r. Like this. So my ground state of this Hamiltonian will be proportional to r gamma 0 plus p gamma 1, right? And my original algorithm says at the beginning I start with p and r equals to 0, q equals to 2. I gradually change it to p equals to r equals to 1. And that gives me the desired evolution. Now, suppose you do a mirror evolution that takes this Hamiltonian to q equals to r, q and r equals 0 and p equals to 2. And since you're doing this adiabatically, the ground state will still have this form, right? And you can check that the ground state is u applied on 0. That is, at the end, instead of getting the history, you get exactly the output of the quantum circuit that you want. So the key point here is that we have essentially completed a holonomic cycle. We essentially come back to the same Hamiltonian because, well, this is not exactly the same Hamiltonian as this, but you can either relabel the clock field this, or you can take p equals 0 back to q equals 0. That won't change the result. So it's essentially a loop. And you have, with this loop, you've applied the quantum gate u. And we can even set p, q equals to r squared throughout the evolution to make sure the gap is a constant. So this gives us a lot of freedom in manipulating the gap. And this works even for multiple gates. So consider the evolution.
I didn't follow in detail, but okay. In principle, the holonomy has nothing to do with the spectrum of the gen. It's just a question of the projectors. Why do you say by that you can adjust, you can change the, or have an influence on the gap?
I'm saying it's what usually when people do this kind of holonomic cycles, they keep the gap constant. But I'm saying that if you do this history approach of adiabatic evolution and do some sort of mirror evolution, it will turn out to be, as long as it's adiabatic, it will turn out to be the same as doing a holonomic cycle. Mm-hmm. It's a surprising coincidence, you know, you can say.
Okay, but the holonomy is easy.
No. Okay, so this actually works for multiple gates. So if I have this starting Hamiltonian like this, taken to the final state as a superposition of the entire history of a circuit, I can construct is another set of Hamiltonian H prime corresponding to a circuit that's the reverse of my original circuit, which is like, so U dagger, L dagger, L minus 1, etc. This set of Hamiltonian would take psi I prime equal to, which is this, to psi F prime. I mean, you just have to stare at the expression to convince yourself. And it's easy to see that psi F is really the same as psi F prime, up to relabeling of the clock qubits. So if we implement the evolution, that we take H sub I, H initial to H final, relabel it and think of it as H prime final, and it eventually evolve it back to H I prime. We would have taken the state psi I to psi I prime, like this adiabatic evolution is reversible. And this means you basically start with the initial state. At the end, you end up with not a superposition of the history, but the exact output of your quantum circuit. So the lesson is that this history state approach is kind of like half of doing polynomial computing. And there's also that tells us that there's actually room for manipulating the gap size. I mean, in visual spec, we may not have to work so hard with the stochastic matrix and such to prove the gap. I mean, you can vary it. You would have gotten a better gap. So let me now move on to a different topic. So far in the example I described to you, this history state approach requires three local Hamiltonians. Right, is that you need at least one thing that flips the clock and two things that implement the gate. It turns out that there are ways to reduce the three local Hamiltonian to two local. And in general, there are many techniques that you can, many ways to reduce the non-locality of the Hamiltonian. And these kind of approximations can preserve both the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors. And the price you pay, however, is that it will reduce the gap size by polynomial factor. So you can't do this kind of approximation too often. So the basic idea of the perturbation theory is this. Suppose I have a Hamiltonian, let's say it's three local, I call it script H. That has this funny structure on the Hilbert space. It's often possible to come up with two local Hamiltonians, H plus V, such that on a certain on a null subspace of H, you have the H plus V is approximately the same as script H. But this is what I mean by approximation. And when I say you pay the price in terms of the gap, because you have to set this new scale in terms of the delta for the H, so there's always a price in the scale. And let me now call this part of the Hilbert state L minus and this part L plus, that is the ground state and the exciting state of this big H, right? So a theorem proved by Kitaya, Kemp, and Rajiv, it roughly goes as the following, that if you calculate this quantity, which they call the self-energy, sigma minus, and you show that it's close to script H in some interval, then you can show that H plus V is indeed a good approximation of script H. So what is this self-energy term? Well, the idea is that you want to get a sense of what the lower spectrum of H plus V is. But since we are projecting only to the eigenstates of the H, we need to add correction terms, right? Because it's the thing that you should look at to see whether it's close to H script H. It's not just H and V projected to L minus. It's H and V projected to L minus plus some corrections. So this is the formula for sigma minus minus, and the G is what some people call the reduced resolver. To use a particle physics analogy, in case there's any physicists out here, so you can sort of think of H as the free field Hamiltonian of some heavy particle. And we want to calculate the scattering matrix of some low energy, you want to calculate the low energy scattering of some other particles, you will have to include a propagator of the heavy particle, which is the virtual correction. Sure. So this is roughly the idea. So I know this is all very abstract, so let's look at a very concrete example. Suppose I have script H acting on.
Excuse me. So sigma minus minus is just basically T minus 1 over the resolving T minus, is that correct?
It's just a non-compact form of filter. Yes. Okay, so let's look at an example. Suppose I have a script H acting on AB, where AB, you can say, they don't have to be a single qubit. You can think of AB as some subset of the some sets of qubits. Let's say A involves two qubits and B involves two qubits. So by a Hamiltonian acting on AB, I really refer to a four local Hamiltonian, the actual four bodies. So you can find an approximation to this in terms of H plus V that only acts on AC and CB. So this is what it looks like. Suppose my script H has the form PA plus PB squared, where PA and PB are operators acting on just A and B. When you square it, you get a term that's the tensor product of PABB, right? So that's what makes it four local. I mean, this is a particular case, not in general, but just to give you a feel of how it works. If I define H as this operator on qubit C, and B as this following operator that involves AC and AB, then you can just calculate the resolvent and the projections of the V and H, etc. And then the self-energy would have this form. And you see that they can use the fact that when this V plus minus appears twice, you get a square, and then you turn the two local thing into four local. That's how you achieve the approximation. And by setting the delta to be a large number, you can see that sigma minus minus is indeed close to the script H. Okay? So this is just the simplest example. There are other more nasty, complicated gadgets, so-called perturbation theory gadgets. Oh, yes, please.
In such an example, you could also use the trick of Dirac, which consists in taking the square root of P A plus P it consists in tensoring with some extra matrices.
And this sounds interesting, but let's talk about it later. Okay, so in principle, there can be other more complicated of these kind of gadgets. You can use them to not only reduce the locality, but also to change the topology of your Hamiltonian for your implementation. So finally, maybe just show you this rather cute construction of a square lattice. So it turns out that you can implement all these adiabatic stuff on a square lattice using just two local interactions and nearest neighbor, two local nearest neighbor interactions. But this is sort of a thing that only works in principle, because when you actually do it using a gadget, it's extremely complicated. It's polynomial, the cost is polynomial, but it's a huge polynomial factor. So the idea is you take your original quantum circuit, say, imagine it as the row with the blue dots. These are the original qubits in the circuit. And you implement it in such a way that, you say, at the first row, you only apply one gate. Then, before you apply the second gate, you swap everything to the second row and apply the gate again. But this way, you have a lattice that corresponds to the original circuit. And you add these red dots, which is the top qubits, so that every time you apply a gate for an identity operator, you flip the top qubit to keep track of each step. Once you do this, and then go back to the previous construction we look at over here, and then use this kind of free local Hamiltonian reduction. Then you will see that all the interactions are either between these red dots or on the triangle between two blue dots and one red dot. So it already sort of make things, fit things in the plane. And once you have this, you can now use the gadgets that I referred to just now to reduce this further to nearest neighbor to local interactions. And you can, at the end, you can fit everything into a grid. So it's something that really works in principle, but that's it's remarkable because it's sort of an equivalent. It tells you that this that two-dimensional Hamiltonian lattice with spins is, has enough complexity to contain all these things. I mean, if you use this for proving the Gram-Lake completeness stuff, I mean, it's really an analogy of the proof that the Eisenstein spin glass is NP-hard. That was the proof back in the 1982 by Barahona. So this is an analogy of that. So any questions? Is there any part that you want me to go over in more detail?
No, actually, I mean, you ended just on the original time. So
okay,
it's
good.
Questions, or we can, people can also ask questions after we'll come to call.